You know, one of the most helpful aspects of the Al-Anon Fellowship is the opportunity to hear someone else share how they've used the tools of the program, the slogans, the 12 steps, and the traditions, and how that use has changed their life for the better. We're very privileged and fortunate that Chink has been willing to travel to Tyler today to do just that, to share with us all her own experience, strength, and hope. And she has an exciting and fabulous story, and I'm not going to take another minute of the time. I want to introduce her now. Please meet Chink and give her a warm welcome.
Thank you. Love you. Don't say a prayer for me. I need it. Okay. My name is Chink Aubrey, and I'm a grateful member of this worldwide fellowship called Al-Anon.
Hi, Chink.
Can you alcoholics hear me in the back? I want you to be sure and hear me. I talked for 15 years to one. That's 2 feet from me. Never heard a word I said. not one. Still doesn't sometime. My friend Annette came with me this weekend, and we were laughing and commenting about what all we've done since we started out. We left Friday morning real early in the rain, and we found it only takes 28 hours to get to Tyler. But the way we travel, we stop at all flea markets, we stop at all antique shops, we stop at all the good things that women like to stop at and enjoy, and we ate a lot along the way. That's something I've learned that I can do in the Al-Anon program. I used to think my husband had to go everywhere with me and do everything with me, and because that's the way it was, and he didn't enjoy it, and I didn't either, and so we finally learned how to communicate due to this program. I want to thank Rod and Kathy for giving me a call and asking me to share. I always feel it's a privilege to share anywhere, to give a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope. Because, you know, I never dreamed that I'd ever be in a program, a 12-step program, that would turn my life completely around. I've had so many people in AA that told me when I first came in that if I'd get the spiritual side of the program, that the physical and mental would fall in place. And I really wasn't interested in the spiritual side of the program. I had an alcoholic that drank 24 hours a day. He drank every night until he passed out, and I was interested in getting him sober. I picked up a joke. I love jokes. I love to laugh. I like to have a good time. And I think that if you don't enjoy laughter and enjoy living, there's something wrong with your program. Because I think that we're supposed to be happy, joyous, and free. And I've cried all I want to cry. But this joke said that the doctor had just finished giving the young hillbilly a physical. And he came back out, and the hillbilly was real concerned because he didn't feel good. His stomach hurt. His head hurt. He ached all over. And the doctor said, I'm going to tell you something. He said, the best thing for you to do is to go to bed early at night and to give up drinking and get away from all those wild women you're running around with. And the old hillbilly sat there on the table, and he looked up at the doc, and he said, well, let me tell you, Doc, I really don't deserve the best. What's the next? I like that. I like that. Y'all have a nice crowd here today, and I'm real grateful. You know, I'm comfortable talking into a real small group. Much more so than a packed house. I get nervous. I get nervous anytime. It takes me about 5 minutes to get this thing to stand still. And my knees, you know, knock a little bit, and Gwen's made me very comfortable. I mean, we've had some laughter and everything, and I do feel more relaxed now. But speaking's not my thing. But I had a friend in my Al-Anon meeting that she said, you can get up and you can share your experience, strength, and hope, and that's all you have to do. And so that's what I'm going to do. And when I tell you the way it was, I tell you the way it was. And it wasn't, honey, will you pass the biscuits? It wasn't like that. My husband said that we were married 19 years before he realized his first name was Ed. And I'm not proud of that, but that's the way it was at our house. I was an only child, and I was born and raised in a small town in northeast Texas, a little town called Honey Grove, and some of y'all know where it is, and we just had a ball there this weekend. They're some of the dearest people that live in that town still. And yet I couldn't wait to get away from there. I was an only child, and my mother and daddy gave me a lot of love, but I didn't like discipline. I never did like discipline. I wanted to do things my way. And I could wrap my dad around my little finger just like that. I mean, anything I wanted or any time I wanted to go somewhere or do anything, it was all right with him. With my mother, it was a different story. I finished high school there, and I enrolled in North Texas State Teachers College. And I went a couple of months and quit. I didn't want to go to school. And I went back home, and I stayed home for a while. And my mother and I did not get along, and we had, as long as I was a small child, we got along because she had control. But it was when I got up and discovered boys and got into high school and everything that things started changing. I loved my mother. She was a good lady. It was just that we were so much alike. Our temperaments were so much alike. And I know that she loved me. And I know, and I'm very grateful to be in a 12-step program where I could make amends to my mother before she died. I told my mother many times, I said, you know, when I get up to be a lady and meet a man that I think loves me, that I'm going to marry him, and I'll never talk to my husband the way that you talk to my daddy, because I've seen my mother throw tantrums, and my daddy was a kind, easygoing man, and he'd just turn and walk away. He wasn't a wimp or anything. He just didn't like arguments, and he'd never say anything back. Now, I married a boy that's just exactly like my daddy. I mean, I can throw tantrums or get mad or whatever, and he would never say anything back. And I want to tell you something, that hurts. That hurts. Because you have to live with the words that you put out, and you can't get those words back. After I finished high school and started going to college, I decided I didn't want to go to college. I came back, and I got a job working there at a little picture show. And I was cashier there, and there was a boy came through and worked there in that town for a while, and sure enough, he asked me to marry him, go back to Kansas City with him. And so we were married, and I moved to Kansas City, and I knew that when the minister said that he pronounced us man and wife, that I had done something that I wish I hadn't done. That was not the way a marriage should start out. But I married to get away from my mother. And so now I'm going to show her that I can live with this man and I can love him and I can be a wife to him. And for 4 years I lived in Kansas City, and I was not a real unhappy person, but I wasn't a happy person. And so I decided that I was going to call my uncle in Norman, Oklahoma. And I called him and I asked my uncle, could I come live with him? And he said yes. Because see, I was his favorite niece. And so I went to Norman, Oklahoma, and this is during World War II, and I'm going to tell y'all that I am not a young spring chicken, and you can tell that. Like I said, the time I get through undressing at night, there ain't much left of me. But anyway, what you see is what you get. So anyway, I moved to Norman, Oklahoma, and went out and applied for a job out there and got to be cashier at the South Base at Norman. And I worked there, and there was a lot of boys there, and I like boys better than women, and so I enjoyed my work out there. And I went to a lot of dances, and I went to a lot of the parties and things, and I had a good time. There was a boy came into my life, and I just knew that he was absolutely the one that I was going to marry. And we went together 4 years, and everything was going good. And when one night he came up to the house, And he said he had something to talk to me about. And I said, well, what is it? And he said, Chink, he said, I don't know how to tell you this, but he said, I don't think I'll be back. And it just, my balloon just went down. And I said, well, what's wrong? And he said, I don't know what to tell you. He said, but I just want to get away. And I believe today that I smothered that boy until absolutely he couldn't breathe any longer. I watched every move that he made. I called, I checked on him and everything else. Because, see, I wanted somebody that I could just hold and love to pieces. I wanted something that was mine, and I thought that's what he was. And so that night after we talked over and I went in the house, I mean, my world was totally destroyed. Because I loved this man with my heart, body, and soul. And I knew that it was all over. There was for a while that I did not go anywhere or do anything. I had come back come up to Oklahoma City after the base closed, and I got a job working there, and I would go to work of a morning, and then I'd go home at night, and I'd go to bed. And, I mean, I really did not care any longer. I thought that the God of my understanding at that time was a revengeful God, and that he was really zapping me good. And I kept thinking, is it the way I lived when I was in high school and partying and having a good time, or what was it? But I knew I didn't want anything to do with that God. And I'll do it my way, and I'll live my own life, thank you. And that's what I did for a while. And so I didn't know anything about prayer. I didn't go to church. I lived my way. There was a girl that lived there in the home where I did, and Mary Jane was going to get married. And I was angry about that because we had talked about all this and everything, you know, and she did. They got married and they moved to a little home there, and she said, later on said, I want you to come over and to have dinner with us. And I said, Mary Jane, I don't care about going out and eating. I said, I've got a good job, and that's all I'm evidently supposed to be doing is working and going home. And they would come over after me and try to get me to go, and I wouldn't go. One night, she called me, and she said, I'm not going to call you, but one more time. And she said, I'm going to ask you one more time, will you come over and have dinner with us? You can't live that kind of a life. And so I had on a pair of shorts and a little halter top. Hair wasn't combed because if you're like me, when you get home from work, you're tired and you're hot, and man, it all comes off and you just want to be comfortable. And I thought, well, I'm going over there and I'll have dinner with her and then I'm coming home. And I went over and sat down in the living room. She said, I'll have dinner ready in just a little bit. So go read the paper. So I went in there and sat down on the divan. I was reading the paper. And I didn't hear this person walk up on the porch. But he just barely knocked, opened the door, and walked in. And I looked at this tall, good-looking man, and he's about 6'1", and had the prettiest blue eyes I've ever seen in my life. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I knew right then I was willing to go to any lengths to get what he had. We had a good time that night. We had a good dinner, and Ed took me home. And we sat out in the car and we talked, and he told me all about his life. He told me some of his life. I learned later more about his life. And I told him all about me, and I didn't leave out very little. And so we started going together. And we went together every night. I want you to know we went together every night for 6 months. And I was nearly dead, and he was too, and his mother said one night, she said, I don't know why you kids don't get married. She said, you're just wearing each other out. And I said, I think it's a good idea. And so when Eddie took me home that night, I said, I think your mother had a good suggestion. And I wanted to talk to you about it. I said, I've been in a relationship. It did not work for me. Back in that time, we called it shacking up. We didn't call it relationships. That was the real hardcore word for it. It did not work for me, and I doubt that it'll work for you. Because, you see, I didn't have God in my life then. I'm doing things my way. And God will come back into your life sooner or later. He did mine. And so I told Eddie, I said, I want to tell you one thing. I said, I've been hurt, and I've been hurt deeply, and I love this guy with all my heart. And I said, but I'm going to tell you, I do not intend to go with you and live with you and act with you the way I did. If you want me, then we're going to get married. And I said, do you want to get married? And he said, yes. And so that did it. I proposed, he accepted, and we were married on May the 21st, 1950. And so we just recently celebrated our 45th wedding anniversary, and that's another story. I'm on a dry, and that's the same as a dry drunk. And I'll tell you more about that after a while. But we have a good marriage. There's a lot of things happened in our life when we got married the first year. And I still wondered about God and what had I done that I was having to pay so much. And this would go in my mind. But you see, I was really crazy about my dad. And I mean, he was the God I looked up to. And they called me one morning at 7:30 and they said that my dad had died of a heart attack. And I want you to know that I hated God with a passion. Because as long as he was there, I was not afraid of anything. I knew I could call my dad, and I knew that he was there. And now he's taken away from me, and I really did not care for God. I mean, I hated him with a passion. I stood in my living room, and I told God that I didn't like him. I told him that I wasn't being treated right. We went home, buried my dad, and came back. And it couldn't have been 6 months later that Eddie had been married once before and had a little 3-year-old son. And we had the opportunity to get that little boy on December the 24th, full custody of him. And so we go to court and we get full custody of this little 3-year-old boy. And I became an instant mother and I didn't know anything about being a mother. But again, the thoughts went in my mind, I'm going to be a good mother to that child. And I'll never treat him the way that mother treated me. Now, mother was not mean to me. She was one that disciplined me. But at that time, I felt like I took a lot of abuse from her when she'd get angry at my dad. And I found out later on that I used a lot of my anger on that little 3-year-old boy to get even with my husband. I'm not proud of that. I'm glad I'm in a program today that I can make amends. And I have made my amends to that boy, and we have a good relationship. But we got custody of Bobby, and my mother was still living in Honey Grove, and we decided to move her up to Oklahoma City with us. So now we've got a little boy, and now we've got a mother, and here's Eddie and me, and the house is a little bit crowded. But my mother was just like a babysitter for us. The boy loved her dearly. They got along real well together. I had a good job. Eddie had a good job. So there was very little work that I had to do. Eddie drank quite a bit, and I knew that he drank because I had partied with him and I had drank with him. But booze didn't do anything for me. I could take a drink and sip on it all night long, or I could drink just a Coke, and I was perfectly happy. But my alcoholic there that I was so crazy about, you know, he'd drink a beer, but he didn't care for beer. And then he'd start mixing Windsor Canadian. And then it was just straight Windsor Canadian. And I'm watching him because, you know, I don't like that. I want his attention, and I want him to do things my way, and drinking is not one of my ways. So I'm going to take it upon myself and to kind of stop him, and the tension began to kind of build up. And I can see how it does, because let me tell you something, 40 years later, he's watching me now, and I don't like it. You know, he's doing things that I used to do. I don't know if it's happening in y'all's life, but the alcoholics reversed on me now, and I'm doing things he did. And I said, hey, this is a crazy mixed up world. You know, it really is. But we're having fun with it now. But I was watching him, and he would go out to party or something, and most of the time I had to drive home, and this aggravated me too, because he lay over there and sleep. I'm not telling Eddie's story. He told me I could, he said, if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't have a story. And I said, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't need a story. So, but anyway, the communication began to slack up there, because Eddie come home from work and he'd fix him a drink and go out in the garage. And he was a ham operator and he stayed out there a lot, and so I didn't think anything about it. I thought, you know, he's talking to the boys and everything's going fine. And I'd stay in the house and argue with Mother and Bobby and get all uptight and everything and go on to bed. And this went on and on and on. And they say when you look for trouble that you can always find it. Now, Eddie would, we have 2 steps into the kitchen, and Eddie would come in at night around 11:30 or 12, and sometimes he'd make both steps, sometimes he'd make one of them and hit the floor. And I always thought, he's so tired, and he stays out there in that garage so long, he really needs to get more rest and more sleep. And it wasn't that at all. Then I got to looking at his eyes. I got to studying him. Did any of y'all ever study your alcoholic? I know a lot of times he'd lay back in the recliner, and I'd go over there and open his eyes up like that, and I'd look at him, and wasn't nobody home. And if there's something else that I left out, and y'all tell me after it's over, because I tried everything that I knew to get him sober. I sat on that chair by Eddie so many times, and I'd look at him because I knew that I loved this man, but I knew that he was drinking too much and things were getting out of hand. And I told him, I said, Eddie, I said, don't lie to me. I can't stand somebody to lie to me. Don't lie to me about drinking. And he said, I'm not drinking, just a little glass, you know, of booze every now and then. And so I tried to go along with that. I sit on the side of his arm and I'd say, Eddie, tell me what's wrong with me. Because I thought, if you tell me what's wrong with me, I'll try to do different. Because I really wanted that marriage to work. And he'd say, Chink, there's nothing wrong with you. And I'd say, well, why can't you stop drinking? And he'd say, honey, I can anytime I want to. You heard that before. And I guess at that time he really thought he could and that he wasn't drinking enough. I don't know. But the tension kept on going. I mean, it just kept getting heavier and heavier and heavier. Mother and I got into it. My mother moved out. And Bobby got where he didn't want too much to do with me. He would, you know, be around me a little, but very little. And Eddie would keep this drinking up, and so I thought, you know, it's up to me to stop him from drinking. And so have you ever talked to your alcoholic, and that just goes in one ear and out the other, they don't hear a word you say? And I can't stand that rejection. I mean, I want you to hear what I've got to say. And so I told Eddie, I said, you know, I talk to you, and it doesn't mean a thing to you, and I'm going to treat you just like you treat me. I said, for about a week, I'm not going to say a thing to you. I said, I'm just going to ignore you. And so for about a week, I'd get up of a morning, and I'd pass Eddie in the hall, and he'd look at me and smile. The man never gets mad. I told Rod this afternoon, he makes me so angry. He never gets mad. He never gets upset. He just accepts the world the way it is and goes on, and he has a beautiful day every day. And I'm just the opposite. I've got to work through things. I'm an Al-Anon. I'm a sick Al-Anon. I still have to work through some of these things. But I've got a program, and I know when I need to level off. But I sit there, and I'd tell Eddie, I'd say, Eddie, you know, right up here, I know this brain is telling me what I ought to do, but I know my heart's telling me something else, and they wouldn't get together. And I think I'll try something else just one more time. And I'd tell him, I'm not talking to you for a week. And I wouldn't. I wouldn't say anything to him. I'd look at him. I'd set the table. And I wouldn't talk at breakfast. We had a little dog, and it was a little rat terrier. And her name was Lucille. And I'd say, Lucille, go tell your daddy breakfast is ready. And that little dog would go in there and look at Eddie, and here she'd come back. And Eddie would appear in the front, and we'd sit down and eat breakfast, and he'd go to work. That dog communicated for us because we didn't talk. We'd send messages by this little dog. I tried divorce 3 times. Now, I want to tell you something. You know, I would think if I start to divorce him, he'll see that I'm really serious and things will change. Well, I packed his clothes up. I packed his electric steel guitar up, and I can't even lift that thing now. But I packed that steel guitar up and the amplifier. I packed everything he had in his car, and I told him, I said, Eddie, I said, I'm filing for divorce, and I want you out of here. And what made me mad was he got in the car, and he backed out, and he waved at me like that. That wasn't the way I wanted him to leave. And so I let him stay gone for about 30 days, and then I'd call him, and I'd say, Eddie, I need to talk with you. Because, you know, living in a house by yourself is pretty lonely. And when you get to thinking about it and taking your only inventory, you had a big part in that. Or I did. I'm speaking for myself. But I thought, you know, maybe I could have been a little bit different. Maybe I could have acted a little bit different. And I'd call him and I'd tell him that I wanted to talk to him. He'd come over and we'd go back together. But nothing had changed. Nothing had changed. He's still drinking and I haven't gotten a program yet or done anything different. There was another time that I worked at the hospital. I've tried everything there is to try to get the alcoholic sober because by now he was really drinking into heavy drinking. And I worked the emergency room charts. And I remember going into one of the charts one day and it had down DOA, and that's dead on arrival. And out at the side it said alcoholism. And I thought, I need a copy of that to take home and show Eddie that it can kill you. And I Xeroxed a copy off. I went home, and I waited on him. And when he came in, I said, Eddie, I said, fix your drink. I want to talk to you now. So he fixed himself a drink, and I said, honey, see this chart right here? It says DOA, and he said, yeah. And I said, out here it says alcoholism. I said, that stuff will kill you. And he sat there, and he took another swig of his drink. And I said, and look down here. The diagnosis says acute alcoholic. And he said, that's what I am, acute alcoholic. I don't care what I did or what I said or how hard I worked to get him sober. It backfired on me. It always backfired on me. Everywhere that I go and share, somebody say, tell this story about the Epcac. So I'm going to tell the story about the Epcac. I worked out there, and I went through the emergency room one day. This little boy was out there, and he was so sick. He was up chucking all over everything. And I stopped, and I said, what in the world's wrong with that child? And they said, he's taking an overdose, and they gave him some Epcac and a Coke, a teaspoonful. And I said, good Lordy, it makes him throw up like that? And she said, yeah. And that little light bulb just started flickering up there, and I thought, well, I'm going to get me some of that, and I'm going home. And so the nurse gave me a bottle of it for my grandkids that I didn't have, and I went home. And I had to climb up and get the Windsor Canadian bottle down, but I emptied it out, and I thought, the little boy was small, but 86'1". He ought to have all that in that bottle because it won't work, just a teaspoon. So I took out the bottle of whiskey, and I poured in that whole bottle, shook it up, looked at it through the light, and it was perfect, you know, blend perfect. And I couldn't wait for Ed to come home. He came home that afternoon, and so it was hot, and I said, honey, fix your drink. Need to talk to you. So he came in and sat down and had his drink, and I didn't know that that worked real fast. I thought, you know, like 30 minutes or something like that. And so I was standing behind him, and he took a great big swig of that and swallowed it, and the minute it hit his stomach, it was up. And he was out of that chair, and he was throwing up all over everything. I mean, everything. And it scared the daylights out of me because it hit my divan. It hit the coffee table. He was going into the bathroom all over the floor. And I said, Eddie, hold your head down. God Almighty, hold your head down. Because, I mean, it was all over everything. And I said, that's the first time that Eddie and I ever went down on our knees in prayer. In front of the commode, but he was turning red. His body was turning red. His face was turning red. And the first thought I thought of was, you are going to Big Mac. And I didn't want to go to the penitentiary. And I knew that that's where I was headed. And I prayed to God that if you'll just let him live, I promise you I won't do it again. And I have promised and done things and done the same thing over and over, doing think I'm going to have different results and didn't. I'm going to hurriedly tell you that the very next night we had company, and Eddie asked me, would I fix us something to drink? And I said, Eddie, you don't want anything to drink tonight. And he said, just fix us one drink. And I went in the kitchen, and I was going to fix the drink, and so I looked at the bottle. He had, an alcoholic always has two bottles, or he did. So I got the good bottle that didn't have the Epicac in it. And I fixed one drink. The phone rang, and it was for me. And Eddie said, I'll finish. And he went in the kitchen, and he started fixing out of the other bottle. But there was just enough for one. So when he got through and brought those drinks in, I'm sitting there, and I'm really praying now because I don't know how many I got going to throw up at the same time. But he was the one that got the drink that had the Epicac in it again. And so Jacqueline and Johnny sitting there, and we were visiting, and Eddie took this sip, and he took a great big sip of it, and he did exactly the same thing he did the night before. He started out up checking all over everything, and Jacqueline's eyes got about like this, and she said, my God, he's going to die. And I said, I know it. I know it. And I go back in the bathroom, and I'm bathing his face, and I'm saying to God again, I promise you this time, really, I won't do it again if you just let him live. And for a couple of days, he didn't drink, but it did not stop him. I have tried everything there is to get the alcoholic to stop, and I've tried things that hurt, and I'm not proud of. I remember one time, Eddie loves country and western music, and they were having a telethon. He came home one night. He said just to be with me, and I knew what he came home for. He came home to fix a drink to watch that country and western telethon. I was way ahead of him. So I go to bed early, and about the time that I get almost asleep, my bed starts rocking like that. And I raised up to see what's caused it, and he's sitting in there in the bedroom. He's got his feet on the springs of the mattress, you know, and the music's playing, and he's vibing with it, you know, going right along. My bed just rocking. And I said, Eddie, get your feet off this bed. I've got to work in the morning. And he said, I come home to be with you. And I said, you didn't come home to be with me. You came home to drink and watch that damn music. I'm going to tell you that this is the way I talked when Eddie was drinking. And I'm going to talk the way I've talked then. Because I was taught later on that I had to clean up my act and clean up my language and let you know that I have changed. And that's exactly the way. But that's the way I talked then. I said, get your damn feet off this bed. And he said, let me tell you something. He said, I may walk out of here and I may not come back. I said, do whatever you want to. Well, he decided to go to bed. So he flipped the light out. And he was going to go over me, and I'm laying there on my back. And I thought, I'll help the son of a bitch. So I put my feet up like that, and we go over like that. And he overshot the runway. He was down on the floor, and the next day while I was at work, he called me. And he said, Chink, he said, I tell you, I can't breathe. And I said, what's wrong? And he said, I don't know. I must have pleurisy. He said, I really ache. And I said, well, let me call the doctor. Get you an appointment. So he went to our family doctor, and the doctor x-rayed him, and he had two broke ribs. And I thought, I know how he got those broke ribs, but I'm not saying anything about it. You know, let him figure it out. And I got the worst deal of that, because he laid in the recliner for almost 6 weeks with two ribs broke, and I had to bring him his meals. You know, I weighed on him hand and foot. And I thought, you know, I never learn. I keep doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. I had read in 41, I guess, whenever that article of Jack Alexander's came out in the Saturday Evening Post. I'm a reader, and I graduated from high school in 41. But I really believe that I read that article, because one afternoon when Eddie and Bobby and I were there at the house, and I'd been cleaning up our house and everything, and you know, some of us Al-Anons feel put upon because we are put upon. And I like to feel that way, you know, when I'm feeling sorry for myself. And so, Eddie was in there and Bobby watching TV, nothing going on, and I walked in there and I put my finger right in his face and I was telling him what an SOB he was. And nobody's talking except me, and I'm right between him and the TV. And Eddie just looked at me like, you are so sick. And Bobby looked at me, and by then that child was about 12 years old. And he looked at me, and he said, Chink, my daddy's all right. You're the sick one. You're the sick one. And I started crying, and I went to the bathroom, and I closed the door. And I stayed in there for a while, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I thought, what's wrong with you? You used to enjoy life. You used to laugh. You used to have a good time. And look at you now. You don't have makeup on. You don't have your hair combed. You don't give a crap. You know, what's wrong with you? Eddie's not bothering anybody, and Bobby's not bothering anybody, and you're raising hell. And something in my mind kept saying Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know where it was or what it was. But it just that little inner voice kept saying Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I went in, and I thought, I'm going to call. If I can find a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to call down there and see if I can get help. And I found the Kelly Club, and I've got a friend calling already, shaking his head. I called to the Kelly Club, and there was a man down there. And he answered the phone, and I said, I want to know if you could send two men out to get my husband sober. And he said, honey, he said, does he want to get sober? I said, hell no, he doesn't want to get sober. I want him to get sober. He's passed out. And he said, well, unless he has a desire to stop. Now, this was way back 21 years ago. He said, if he doesn't have the desire to stop drinking, there's not anything we can do. And I gave him peace of my mind and hung up. And I started crying again, and I went back in that bathroom, and I thought, I know that that said Alcoholics Anonymous helps drunks, and my husband's a drunk. And I went back to that phone, and I called again. I got this same man, and I said, I have a friend that has a husband that's an alcoholic, and she needs help. And he said, honey, what's your address? And I said, I live at 1610 Carlisle Court. And he said, I'll send someone out to talk with you. Now, I want to tell you how this program worked. They sent a lady out to talk with me, and her name was Betty J. And that dear little lady came out, and she told me about Al-Anon, and she told me that the program would help me to learn to understand that alcoholic, and that I could be happy whether that alcoholic was sober or not. And I listened to her, and when she got through, I said, Betty, I am not the sick one. He's the sick one. And she said, well, whether you're sick or not, why don't you come go with me to the meeting? And I said, I don't know that I'll like it, but I'll go with you. And so she came and picked me up the very next night. And we went to a meeting, and that meeting was over on the Klassen Club. And the Klassen Club was 3220 on Klassen Boulevard at that time, big old two-story house. And so I went over there, and I knew I wasn't going to like that. Because we had, the Al-Anons had to go around to the back. I'm not second class, I am first rate. And so I go up to the front door and knock, and the AAs open the door and they let me come through. I'll be forever grateful to Woody Ward. That's the sweetest little man, and he had 32 years sobriety. But he was just about my size, and he would come up to me, and a lot of times, and he'd say, Chink, how are you tonight? And I'd say, I'm fine, but Eddie's home drunk. He'd look at me with those beady eyes, and he'd say, I didn't ask you a damn thing about Eddie. He said, I ask you how you are. And I thought, you know, you're really a clown, and you're really smart ass, you know. And so, but he became one of the dearest friends that I have ever had in AA, and he helped me tremendously. He used to say, you know, Ed's going to make it in spite of you. That didn't set well with me either. But anyway, I went for 6 months to Al-Anon. I went with Betty J for quite some time. Now, she has recently been diagnosed with Alzheimer, and she doesn't recognize me or anything like that. And I think, but for the grace of God, that could have been me. But she's the one that came and called on me and took me to meetings. She's a precious woman. Her life did not go like mine did. She and her husband got a divorce, and she's lived alone for many, many years. But Betty helped me an awful lot. She would not give up on me, and she said, Chink, she said, you've got to go to the meetings, and you've got to listen. I was one that interrupted. If you said something and I didn't like it, I'd say, yes, but, or what if. And they'd say, pat me on my knee and say, honey, just keep quiet and listen. Just keep quiet and listen. And I'm so grateful to all those old-timers that were here, because Gertrude was another one, and she used to tell me, Chink, you know, just listen. Just listen. And I'd get real aggravated at her. And she's saying, if you ever share at open meetings or anything else, she said, just be Chink. Don't add on and don't take away from, because those people can read you like a book. And I know that to be the truth. And that's what I said. I try to speak from the heart to reach another's heart. And so anyway, I went to Al-Anon for those 6 months. And I went almost every night. Now, they told me I had to work 12 steps, and I told them I wasn't going to be here that long. I didn't intend to work 12 steps. I saw the slogans, and I thought, I like all the slogans except but for the grace of God. And I don't want that one, but I'll try all these others. And so I bought the literature, and I read the books on the slogans, and I thoroughly enjoyed them. I'm a reader, but I'm not going to work steps. After 6 months, my husband's still drinking, and he's drinking a lot heavier than he was. And so I decided, well, I'm going to quit. It's not doing him any good. It's not doing me any good. It's taking a lot of my time. Why should I have to go when he's the one that's sick? I quit my job, quit to going to Al-Anon, and on March, I've forgotten what year, but it was a real cool March morning, and I worked at the Baptist Hospital at that time, and so I go out to Baptist Hospital to eat breakfast. Eddie has changed jobs now, and he's working at the sheriff's office. He's now deputy sheriff. And so I thought, you know, I have pulled him out of the bed. I have dressed him. I have got him ready to go to work so that he'd keep his job, and I'm not doing it anymore. So this morning I'm going to get up, and I'm going to dress, and I'm going to go out and eat breakfast at the hospital, and I'm going to do things my way. And so I got up and dressed. I got ready, and I went out to work. At that time, the hospital was under construction, and we had to park two blocks down and go to an access road and up to the hospital. And when I got out in the parking lot that morning, it was dark yet, and so I parked under one of the street lights and got out of my car and locked it. And I saw this man go by in front of me, and he had on a stocking cap and a little leather jacket, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I thought he was an employee, because the employees are always coming and going. And we're walking, he's walking ahead of me towards the north, and I'm right behind him. And all of a sudden, somebody grabs me right here, and he put a .38 in my stomach. He had me up on my toes, right up against him. And I just closed my eyes, and I said, God help me. And it really gets to me, because I had never asked God to help me do anything. Don't help me, help Eddie. Don't help me, help somebody else. But I'd never in my life, as long as I could remember, saying, God help me. But this man had me there, and he's breathing in my face, and he said, come on. And I said, I'm not going. Thank God for Al-Anon. They told me easy does it. They told me to be quiet and to listen, and I just tried to be calm. And I repeated to him again, I'm not going. And take my purse or take my car, but don't hurt me. Don't do something you're going to be sorry for. And I don't think he knew what he had a hold of, because he said to me again, come on. And I said, no, I'm not going. And when I said that, a car came into the parking area, and the lights hit us. And when they did, he shoved me back, and he started running to the south. And I reached down, got my purse, and I started walking. And I thought, this little inner voice said, everything's going to be all right. Everything's going to be all right. And I just kept walking, and I didn't look back. And I got halfway up to the hospital. And you know what came into my mind? Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me. And man, I went all to pieces, because I believe that there is a God. He does love me. And when I really needed him, he was there. And I realized then that he's been with me all these years. I went into the emergency room, and they called my husband, and he came and got me, and he had to go through all the police work and stuff. And so we went down there, and I don't know, when I got in that car and I looked at Eddie, I had a different feeling for him. I couldn't explain it. I just had a different feeling for him. He is a child of God. He is a human being. He has a heart. He can love just like I can. And he is a child of God, and God loves him. And I looked at him, and I said, Eddie, I'm going to tell you something. I said, I know a spiritual experience. I know it was, because I said, I absolutely felt the presence of God in that parking lot. And I've never had that feeling before in my life. And Eddie said, he would have killed you. I said, he didn't. And that's what counts, he didn't. And I'm going to Al-Anon tonight. I don't care what we have to do today, but I'm going to Al-Anon tonight. And this time I'm going for me instead of for Eddie. And I went back to my Al-Anon meeting that night. And I told him, I said, I'm here because I want to learn what I'm supposed to do. And I started listening, and I started learning. And I believe that I did have to work the steps. I heard him say the three reasons that I ought to be at an Al-Anon meeting. That's to help myself, to better understand the alcoholic, and to find a more spiritual way of living. And I was slacked off on all of them. I went to a meeting just about every night. And I did not say, Eddie, I wish you'd go or anything else. What I learned to say was with common courtesy, Eddie, I'm going to an Al-Anon meeting tonight. It's because I love you. And I'll be back in about an hour and a half. And I'll see you later. And I walk out the door. And Eddie told me later on, he said, you know, I wanted to drink and I wanted to have that drink before you got home from work, from the meeting. But you got where you stayed out a little bit longer and a little bit longer because, you see, they were saying, let's go have pie and coffee. And I enjoyed going and having pie and coffee and listening to other alcoholics and Al-Anons talk. And I kept going with them and going with them. And I wasn't scared to come home. I didn't have to lie to him. A lot of times I'd come in, and I can tell you exactly when I released Eddie with love. I came into the living room one night, and he was in the middle of the floor, and he was passed out. And I had drug him to bed many a night. I pushed him to bed many a night. I've shoved him to bed many a night. I picked him up and put him in bed many a night. But that night I said, you know, that's your choice to be down the floor. I didn't put you there. And I stepped over him, and it's the hardest step I ever took in my life. I stepped over him, and I said, God bless you. And Eddie said, you know, when I started waking up in the floor at night, there's something wrong with my program. He said, I don't know what it is, but there's something wrong here. I'm about to freeze to death at night. I also turned the furnace down as low as I could get it. But but I learned to smile and to laugh, and I was beginning to get back. It used to be me. I was beginning to feel good inside because I know today that there is a God that loves me, and I want this program. And it says in the AA big book that they want us to be happy, joyous, and free. They absolutely insist on it, and I love that. I love it. So anyway, I started going to the meetings, and I was enjoying I would go to more than one group. You know, I was playing around with the different groups to see which one I went. But I went back to the very first one that I ever went to. Right when I thought that things were going to be good, you know, I'd be tested a little bit. Something would happen, and it wouldn't, I'd have to, what I'm trying to say is that I'd try to use a slogan. Somebody said something about the slogans today, and I said, I lived on the slogans. I lived on the serenity prayer. And I'll be forever grateful to Ramona. Some of you knew her. Because she sat up in the middle of the bed with me a lot of times, and I called her my silent sponsor because she told me, she said, tell them that I'm your sponsor. And I said, no, Ramona, I said, you're my spiritual sponsor. I said, Winona's my sponsor, the lady that lives there in Oklahoma City. Because, see, Winona is right there by me, and I can talk to her, and I can be with her, and I don't have a sponsor that's a way off where I can't get a hold of him. And, but anyway, I was at the work one afternoon, and Eddie called me, and he said, I'm going to go with you to that meeting tonight. And I said, you are? And he said, yeah. And he said, I'm not going to sign anything, and I'm not going to give him my name, and I'm damn sure not going to give him any money. And I said, it's all right with me, because you see, at that time, it really didn't make a difference to me. I would love for him to come go with me, but I'm not insisting on it because I know he's got to make that decision. And so when I got ready to go that afternoon, he came out and he had on a suit. I don't think I've seen a suit on him since, but that night he had a suit on, and he was all dressed up. And you know, I was proud to go to the AA meeting with him. He looked good, and he didn't drink, and we went to the Kelly Club, and this is the way that God works in my life again today. We went to that meeting at the Kelly Club, and we were late, and we had to sit at the back. And as we came in, there was one man that was talking from the podium. And I looked at him, and it was Leroy B. And this man and I had worked together 15 years in a wholesale jewelry company there in Oklahoma City. Eddie looked at me, and he said, my God, is that Leroy? And I said, yeah. He said, I didn't know he was in AA. I said, I didn't either. And I knew that he should have been, you know, because I'd worked with him, and working a wholesale jury, you really see a lot of alcoholics. And so Eddie said, well, had told me that we're going to leave immediately after that meeting was over with. And instead of leaving immediately afterwards, he took my hand and we went down to talk to Leroy. And we walked down there and Leroy said, Chink, is it you or is it Ed? And I said, I guess both of us. He's got it and I'm affected by it. So anyway, he said, I'll pick you up tomorrow night if you'd like to go to a meeting. And he said, I think I will. Eddie went to a meeting with Leroy that night and he come in and he was just kind of like a different person. But I'm going to tell you that I'll be forever grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. Eddie could not make that first year, or he did not make that first year of sobriety. He could go for 2 or 3 weeks, and then he'd have to have another drink. And I could not understand why he couldn't stay off of it if I could, but he wouldn't do it. But he would go with me on Friday nights to open meetings and listen to those speakers. And I'd sit there and I'd watch him and I'd listen, and he shook so bad. My heart just ached for him, because he would take a cup of coffee and hold it the whole meeting. He could not get that cup of coffee up to his mouth. And my heart just broke for him. But like Woody said, he said, he's going to make it in spite of you. And I was trying to release him with love. You see somebody and you're with somebody that you love, you just got to get in there and do it. And you know, God doesn't need any help. He does not need any help. I found that out. I gave out physically, mentally, and spiritually before Eddie gave up the booze. Lucille Scoville says, a lady that was in Al-Anon and recently passed away, she said, we give out physically, and we give in mentally, and we give up spiritually. And I believe that, because in all three areas, I was totally exhausted. Eddie and I did not have a real serene life, even though he was trying to go to AA meetings, stay sober, and I was trying to work the program, but there was something that we weren't doing, and it was with our program that we were not working real good. He had a seizure in the kitchen. And I called the ambulance to get him to the hospital. And again, I thought, you know, this time I've got him. And I work at this hospital, and God and me will get him sober. I got out to the hospital, and Eddie was sitting on that gurney, and he said, go get my clothes. He said, I'm going home. I could not believe that this man could get sober that quick, you know, or look like he was sober and want to go home when he was half dead when they carried him out. And Eddie laughs now, and he'll say, us alcoholics can get sober when we need to. But anyway, I kept going to Al-Anon, and I kept trying to work the program and doing the best that I could. And they told me to get a sponsor. I did get a sponsor. I still have that same sponsor. I have been in Al-Anon 27 years, and I have still got the same sponsor. I would not take for her. She's a beautiful friend of mine. I learned how to work the steps. I learned how to take the steps. I don't know about y'all, but I think that you've got to walk through these steps before you talk the talk. That's exactly the way I feel about it. I know everybody might not agree with me on that, but that's okay. Eddie went into the hospital at St. Anthony, and he was there for 33 days. And how that came about, the morning that I got up and he had that seizure and everything, I went to the sheriff's office and I told him that I had made up my mind that I was going to get out, that I was breaking it, and that I was going to live my life, because I had absolutely given up on Eddie. And I remember Mr. Turner reached up in his pocket, and he was the sheriff at that time. He took out this little card and he said, Chink, honey, you go back home. He said, I'll take it from here. And I looked at that card, and it was the AA 12 and 12, the little card with the steps and the traditions on it. And so I got in my car, and I mean, it was just like in limbo. I wasn't thinking or doing anything. I just went home. As I came in the door, Eddie had tried to get up and to see where I was. And he had fallen and cut his head. The phone started ringing, and I answered the phone, and I said, I can't talk. My husband's hurt himself. It was the sheriff on the other end. I went over and was helping Eddie up off the floor, and I looked up and the police were coming in our house. The ambulance was backing up to our door, and I had not called either. And I started crying because I thought, I've read in the books where other people would come in and they could do for him what you cannot do. And so this man that came in, one of the boys that was on the police, he said, Chink, I'm so-and-so. And he said, I know about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, I'm going to talk with Ed and we're going to go to St. Anthony. And I just stepped back. I thought, you know, they can do it. I can't do it. And Eddie went to the hospital, and he was there for 33 days, and they had talked to me about a little conference in Apache, Oklahoma. And I thought, I've never been to a conference in my life, and I'm going to go. And so I called Betty J, this lady, and I said, Betty, come go with me, and let's try to find Apache, Oklahoma. If y'all know where it is, a little bitty spot out in the cornfield. It's got one blinker light, and you'd miss it. But anyway, it was in February, and we went in January. And so we went to that conference, stayed at Lawton, Oklahoma, and went back and forth in the car. This man, I got to talk to him at this so with. And so, but anyway, we went, and it was snowing, and it was beautiful. And they had it in an old picture show. You go in and just sit down in that old picture show, you know, and the speakers talk from up on stage. And the speaker that Sunday morning was Wesley Parrish. And I love that man with all my heart. That's the most spiritual man I ever heard in my life. He was great. And he stood up there and he said, love's a spontaneous emotion. It has to come from within. And I don't know where I heard anything else not, but I thought, you know, how can you give love if you don't have it? Now, when we came back from that conference, there was a lot of good speakers there, and we had a ball. And when we came back from there, Eddie called me and he said, will you come get me? And I said, yes. I had not seen him in 33 days because I released him. I was going to let somebody else take care of it. I had done all I could do. I had done all the damage I could do. I did not do anything that was right. Little Woody used to tell me, you're doing everything but what you should. And I'd say, Woody, what's that? He'd say, don't do nothing. Leave the alcoholic alone. Let him be responsible for his own actions. And I just couldn't turn loose. Anyway, I came back home and I went to the hospital and picked Eddie up, and it was like two strangers riding in that car going home. I didn't know how to talk to him. He didn't know what to say to me. And finally he said, Chink, I want to tell you something. And I said, okay, well, I'm ready for anything. And he said, they tell me that I've got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous the rest of my life. It's got to be first in my life if I want to keep sobriety. And you'll be second. And I said, that's okay, Eddie. I said, I've been second because booze has been first in our life all the time. I don't care where he places me down the line, just so I'm in there. I have said, and I've said this before, how it is today, and Rod and them kind of laughed. I've said, you know, alcohol's going to dry drunk, and Al-Anon's going to dry, and I've been on a dry all last week. And I'm not proud of it. I know what I should do, and I know what I'm going to do. It took a meeting like this to get up there and say, okay, if you're going to walk the walk, you talk the talk, then go home and say to Eddie, because you started. You know, I hate to have to make amends to him. I really do, because he enjoys it so much. But that's okay. Today, we have courtesy in our home. One of the girls asked me, how do you communicate with your husband? And, you know, I did not know that when communication is when one's speaking and the other one's listening. When we communicated, we both talked at the same time. And I'd say, hush, I want to finish this. And he would. But now then, we have common courtesy, and I can speak to him and tell him exactly how I feel and exactly what's bothering me. And I don't pull any punches. Eddie can rebut me. And maybe it's something that I have thought, and it wasn't at all the way he was thinking. It had nothing to do with it. Somebody asked Eddie, how do y'all get along when you fight? We don't fight. We haven't had a good fight in a long time. I pout every now and then, but I get tired of pouting because he just goes on and accepts me like I am. That's exactly what he said. How do y'all communicate? And he said, I just accept her the way she is. And he's an easygoing person. But, you know, it tells us in our book that we encourage the alcoholic. It doesn't say that we get up and that we run them down and we knock them down and all that. And I'm so grateful I don't have to do that today. I'm so grateful I can say that, you know, I'm married to an alcoholic, and I'm tickled to death. I still let jealousy creep in every now and then. Because, you see, I love that guy, and I know he loves me. And I said, I'm just thrilled to death for alcoholic women and Al-Anon women to go up and hug and kiss my husband. But by damn, don't linger. We do, Eddie and I have a confidence and a trust in each other that we never had before. I mean, really, I didn't trust him out of sight or anything, but today I do, and he does me. We go places together. We go places separate. I found out that he does not like to travel a lot, and I like to go. Now, Annette and I have had a barrel of fun this weekend. We have done things that you men don't like to do. We have made every shop between Oklahoma City and Tyler on our route, haven't we? And our back end of our car is loaded. We bought everything. My husband, we were married 45 years last Sunday. My husband forgot that. I have pouted for 1 week, but I got even. I bought me the cutest short set yesterday and charged it to him. And I can't wait to give him the bill. He told me when I left, he said, Chink, y'all go and y'all have a good time. And I'll see you when you get back. I'm very grateful that y'all asked me to come down and visit with you. And some of y'all have heard my story before. But I'm going to tell you something. The best thing that can happen to you, if you're in Al-Anon, go to the meetings. Just because, as Kathy said, and I picked up from her, just because you're married to an alcoholic does not make you an Al-Anon. Just because you go to a lot of meetings does not make you a member of Al-Anon. There are some things that are requested and required and that we must do, and that's called discipline. We have the greatest meeting in Oklahoma City, and that's the We Tribe group on Thursday night at St. Stephen's Presbyterian Church. Starts at 8 o'clock. If any of y'all are ever there, come see us. We'd be glad to have you. And I want to thank you for inviting me. Thank you. I'm going up here.